Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life. Happy Tuesday.
Happy Tuesday.
Hey, question. This is Matt, by the way. And that baritone you hear is Ben, and that alto slash second soprano voice you hear is Christy.
That's so real.
Mm-hmm. It's real. Hey, if your life was made into a movie, what actor or actress would play you?
I think Meg Ryan.
Now, could
hang on a second.
Yeah, I'm wondering about the parameters here.
You've got male Meg Ryan, or like current, like I'm melting and I don't know how to stop it, Meg Ryan.
What are you talking about?
Have you seen Meg Ryan recently?
No. Mm-hmm. I haven't. Well, I need to Google her. I just think about her from like You've Got Mail.
Yeah.
And like those movies from like the 90s.
Yeah.
Right. So that was my question about the parameters, because is this a timeless, we can pick any actor from any era? Or would it need to be somebody? So for example, if they're going to make if they're going to make a movie about my life, are they going to make it, are they starting it now? And so do I need
good question.
Like a younger actor to play me?
I take my answer back.
I'm not sure what the parameters are.
Yeah. Who would play you right now?
And right now. So like a younger version of me.
And for this, because I sprung this question on you, Christy, you can take You've Got Mail, Meg Ryan.
Okay, yeah. I'm gonna change my answer, and I'm gonna say Mandy Moore. She's gonna have to dye her hair. Mandy Moore, she could do all ages because she can do that because of This Is Us. You know, she just changed her age and decade. Yep. And
there's some people that do have kind of a timeless look, right?
Yeah.
Where you're like, oh, that person's 50, or you're like, that person's 20.
Right.
You don't really know the difference.
Like Tom Cruise.
She could do my whole life.
Yeah, Mandy Moore. Cruise is that way. He looks the same, pretty much, from when he was 20.
Mandy Moore.
But he's like,
I haven't seen Mandy
90
Moore
years
recently.
Old now.
Okay, who would you pick, Ben?
I don't know. You know, the person who immediately popped into my head is not at the right age to play me.
Okay.
And so I'm going to go with kind of what you said, you know, like if I could pick any actor from any era, I would say like young Ethan Hawke.
Okay. Oh.
And yeah. I don't know why I thought of that. I think I just like Ethan Hawke.
That's great.
And he's an Episcopalian. So I feel like he would get me. I'm just joking about that. But
Matt, who would you pick?
I do find it fun that Ethan Hawke is an Episcopalian.
That is funny. I didn't even know that. I think it's obvious, but I'll just say it to make it official. J.B. Smoove. Hello?
Crickets, I guess. Sorry.
Yeah, crickets, yeah. Oh, I
don't even know who that is.
Ready to go.
You don't know who that is?
No.
Oh, that's scary.
Sorry, that wasn't crickets. I'm going to try this again.
Nope. Oh, magical. There
crickets.
We go. Okay.
You really should.
I don't.
Hey, Ben,
I don't
can
know
I talk
who
to you?
Label Matt. Those.
Ben, can I talk to you over here? Real quick.
Christy, hold on. Listener, forward to this.
Ben, they need to have a private conversation.
Over here. Mm-hmm. as producer, you probably should label those buttons.
Probably should label those.
No, you didn't say what kind of movie. He was just saying maybe it was a scary movie. Maybe it was a Disney movie that they were playing you in.
I mean, because absolutely nobody in the entire world has heard of J.B. Smoove.
That's not true.
I think I'm pretty sure that's true. I checked with everybody while you were talking, and I found out that nobody knows what you're talking about. So.
All right. Well, I just sent you guys a text of Meg Ryan then and now. Gird up your eye holes before you look at that.
And then
a picture of J.B. Smoove. He was on Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Oh, that guy. Yeah, sure.
Heard of it?
All right. A few people know who that guy is. Nobody knows if that's his name, though.
Yeah. I appreciate those pictures. That brings... I pick Mandy Moore.
unless we're going with the era, you know, the era that, So, although I will say Ethan Hawke has aged a little better, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm not trying to wrinkle shame anyone, but I do think there's a particular kind of Hollywood look where a person's aging and there's like, you know, 60 pounds of Botox floating around in there. And it's quitting time. And then there's people that get old and just look old, and they don't look like they're melting.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. One of the people who I think is actually aging pretty well is Conan O'Brien. And he always refers to his visage as a rotting pumpkin in the sun. And I think that's pretty funny.
Yes.
That's pretty good.
Oh my goodness.
Anyway, well, we're here to do to introduce an episode.
Yes. Yeah, yes. we got to meet my friend. You got to meet my friend.
I did.
Yeah, you didn't get to meet your friend.
No.
I just texted
you guys. I've already known Tommy for a long time.
Yeah. I just texted you guys Ethan Hawke then and now, by the way.
Oh,
I can't wait to see.
Oh, yeah, he's looking good.
Sorry, listeners.
He's got like kind of a throwback goatee going on. I don't know if he wears that beard all the time.
Ben, I will say, he's less follically challenged than you are.
Yeah, he's still got a full head of hair.
You know,
again, but with the Hollywood stuff, though, who knows what kind of chemicals are involved there? I don't know.
But. He's committed. He's committed to the art. So he probably would either shave or use one of those, face masks that Fox News used a couple weeks ago for one of their interviews. Just put on a realistic looking, you know, silicone Ben Sternke face mask.
Yeah, I have no idea about the Fox News connection there, but.
Oh my gosh.
I trust you that it was bizarre. So
it was, yeah. They had a guest on who had been on before, and it looked like the same guy. But then when you rewatch the video, the mask like stopped just below his collarbones, and you can see the gap between the mask and his body, and it's like
for real.
And it's jiggling a bit as he talks.
Wait, so what's the deal? Was he pretending to be somebody else?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was somebody pretending to be this guy. And he was wearing a realistic, like, silicone.
And it was like a real guy. He was pretending to be a real person.
Yes.
Was the real person in on this? Is he like, please be my body double with this weird mask?
I have no idea.
I don't want to do any more interviews.
That's like a fourth grader trying to, like, approximate AI. It was so bad.
That's bad.
Anyway, you know who's not bad? Tommy Cummins. He's a pastor, communicator, author, and mental health advocate. He has 2 decades of ministry experience, and his work integrates scripture with evidence-based practices shaped by training in youth and teen mental health, first aid, safe talk, assist, soul shop, and QPRT, suicide risk detection. Tommy is passionate about helping everyday followers of Jesus become a healing presence rooted in a life deeply connected to the Good Shepherd. He lives in Colorado with his wife, Mindy, their 2 children, woo-hoo! And an extremely affectionate golden doodle named Sir Chester Shontavious Chewington Esquire.
Tommy, they call him Chewy. Chewy for short.
Yep, Chewy. Tommy enjoys spending time with his family, reading, cycling, disc golf, bird watching, smoking briskets, amen, and cheering for the Oklahoma City Thunder like they can hear him from 600 miles away. Today we're talking with him about his new book, Shepherds of the Mind, Caring Like Christ in an Age of Silent Suffering. Let's get into it with Tommy. This is the 5 seconds we're waiting. Chrissy doesn't like when I talk through it, but I do it sometimes just to keep her on her toes.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Holy cow. Tommy, we are glad that you are here.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's a joy to be here. Chrissy, you're one of the best humans I think I've met. And so that means Matt and Ben, you guys got to be pretty good guys too. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is great. I feel like we're getting we're sort of satellites that orbit around, the main planet, Chrissy. We get like the residual glow
Mm-hmm. No.
From the, right? the blonde hair, the pink headphones, the joyful countenance.
Tommy, yeah,
we're all basking in the glow.
Tommy, how do you and Christy know each other? Maybe we can start by just getting acquainted.
Yeah. So Christy and I were working in Colorado Springs together at the same time about almost a decade ago now, I guess, eight plus years.
Yep.
And so I think we first met when we partnered together for a winter camp.
Yeah. And
got a chance to kind of come together, bring our student ministries together and do winter camps, and then have seen each other at various events throughout the years as well. And so, yeah, go back a little bit.
Yeah. This is so fun for me because I love bringing people that I love and respect to other people that I love and respect. And here we are. So all of you listeners, you get all my fun people. So, and we're here today talking about your new book. But before we kind of dive into that, I'm curious, like, just what made you write this book and how did it really intersect with your personal life?
Yeah, so I actually had the idea for this book years ago, right after I moved to Colorado Springs, from Colorado Springs to Castle Rock, just north of Colorado Springs. My last little bit of time in Castle Rock, a guy named Matt Farrell, who I was working with at the time, great dude, he brought our campus staff together and he shared this verse from Ezekiel 34:4. It says, "The weak you have not strengthened, the sick you have not healed, the injured you have not bound up, the lost you have not sought, the strayed you have not brought back, the lost you have not sought, and with force and harshness you have ruled them." And I was like, man, that's really good. It essentially is like, hey, these spiritual shepherds of Israel are getting chastised for not doing these things. And so, hey, as shepherds, we should be probably paying attention to make sure we are doing these things. And so I started coming up with the outline for this book, again, probably about 8 years ago. And I sat down to write it like 7.5 years ago. And I got like 3 pages out. Literally. And I was like, I don't know what else to say. And it was really frustrating because I was like, oh, there's something here. And so I shelved it for a lot of years. And then in 2021, 2022, I kind of went through my own trauma journey where I had some pretty significant childhood trauma that I had deeply repressed for decades, come back and had to do a lot of EMDR trauma therapy and took 12 weeks of leave from the church that I was working at to be able to kind of lean into this. And it wasn't until I kind of got some decent traction, started getting to a place of deep healing through that journey, that I was hiking with my wife, Mindy, and it was our anniversary. And I asked her on the hike, I said, hey, if you felt like you were on your way to becoming an expert in anything, what do you think it would be? And I expected her to say something along the line. She'd already worked for Compassion International, a child advocacy organization there in Colorado Springs. She had worked for them for almost a decade. And so I expected her to say something along the lines of what she did for them. But she very thoughtfully paused and she said, I think it would probably be sitting with people in the midst of really hard seasons. And I was like, God, that's such a freaking good answer. Like, why did you have to be so thoughtful? Because I just wanted you to say something surface level so I could talk about C.S. Lewis or something like that. But in that moment, it was certainly the Holy Spirit kind of getting a hold of me of like, hey, if you're going to write this book, it needs to have this sort of mental health bend, not only because of my own journey, but because of a lot of the journey that I had already been on of getting into suicide prevention. Christy and I, again, were working together there in Springs about a decade ago when we had 10 students die by suicide in Colorado Springs in a 2-week period. And I think it was this kind of shake the ground moment where a lot of us were like, we have to do something. And so started educating myself in that space. And then again, I think it was that journey of trying already to lead a ministry that creates spaces of psychological and emotional safety where people can talk about the hard things that they're carrying, met with my own journey through some of the very same things that it was like, okay, maybe now it's time to finally sit down and write this book, but with this new flavor of where God had been leading me.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you did, because The Shepherds of the Mind is the book that we're talking about, and it was birthed and it was written and it's really good. I think that a lot of times churches, faith communities, maybe even just our society as a whole often ignores, pretends, hides, feels unsafe to actually be honest about things like anxiety, depression, suicidal thoughts, all of that. And so it's important, I think, for, well, obviously it sounds like there was a whole personal journey that you were going through, but then also in the ministry and the kids and people that you were pouring into, there was a desperate need for words that were wise and gentle and kind and helpful. And I think that that's what this book is. So I wonder, because we've all experienced unsafe places, what are some practical ways to kind of create this kind of emotional safety that helps people stop hiding?
I think there's a lot of things that we can do wrong. Certainly, we've probably all experienced some of what it doesn't look like. And we've probably all had places, both at churches maybe, or even just in our own lives, where it's like, that's clearly not a safe place or a safe person for me. But I think when we kind of work back and figure out, okay, well, how do we make sure we're not doing that? What are some of the things that we can do to create this psychological and emotional safety? I think some of it starts with this journey of just authenticity and vulnerability ourselves in places of leadership to not paint this picture that like, yeah, I'm the pastor or I'm the leader, so I've got it all together. And so I'm really here to help you get it together the way that I've got it together. I think it's just not genuine to lead from that place because we all have things going on in our lives. But I think when we can start to invite others into vulnerability by leading with vulnerability and so I think that's a big piece of it is it opening our own door and sharing some of our own experiences can start to lead people to that place. But I think it's also this journey of destigmatizing the conversation. As a pastor, like I'm really intentional whenever I'm talking to students or adults alike, that when I'm talking about suicide, I'm going to use the word suicide. I'm not going to beat around the bush. I'm going to just say it because I think if we kind of all know we're talking about it of like, yeah, if we're in these really dark places and we feel like we're not safe and you can use this language that is hinting at it without actually saying it. And what I think we unintentionally do in those moments is communicate clearly, I don't want to be talking about this. I won't even use the word. And so I don't want to have this conversation and I feel like I need to touch on it. But I think that's a big piece of it is learning to just destigmatize by obviously not, I talk about this a little bit in the book of being careful not to turn towards a gospel of mental health at the expense of the gospel. And yet also making sure that we recognize the Bible actually talks about mental health and it specifically talks about suicide way more often than I think most people think. There's actually quite a few biblical characters that find themselves in these places of suicidal desperation. Yeah. Some of our biblical heroes even, and there's no fewer than 5, 6, depending on how you categorize it, people who die by suicide in the Bible. And so again, I think having some of these conversations, also just being willing to ask directly the hard question of if I'm starting to pick up on the signs that someone's not doing okay, to be able and willing to check in and just to even ask the question of like, hey, are you thinking about killing yourself? It seems like it's such a, I'm going to put someone on the spot the moment that I ask that question. And yet in my experience and with several of the different organizations that I've been trained through myself, it's like, no, that's the safest thing that you could do is just directly ask the question because it's not going to plant the thought. I think we get this fear that it's going to plant the thought in someone's mind by saying it. But what it actually does is the inverse. It creates this safety of like, oh, they're willing to ask the hard question so I can be honest. And even if they're not in a place of suicidal desperation when the question is asked, well, then it at least now you've labeled yourself as a safe person. If they ever do get to that place, it's like, oh, they were willing to ask. They were willing to talk about that. And so, again, I think there's a lot of different things that we could do, but those would be some of the key things, I think, in our homes, in our ministries that we can do to make sure that we are communicating to others, hey, this is a safe space to talk about whatever hard thing you might be walking through right now.
Listener, as you know, we do not take money from advertisers anymore. We are an entirely listener and participant supported podcast. And so we wanted to invite you into some of the ways that you can do that. The first thing that we wanted to talk about is the Formation course.
I love the Formation course. It actually is probably one of the big markers in my life that made a difference in the way that I followed Jesus and lived for him and thought about him and really did shift something in my perspective.
It's the single most helpful transformational thing we do, and it's a joy to lead, and it really is life-changing if you're looking for an everyday, livable, on the ground, in the details faith.
Yep. It takes a bit of investment. It's a year-long process. To find out more details, you can go to gravitycommons.com/formation to learn all about it. And reach out to us if you have any questions, and hopefully you can join the next cohort. I think, you know, I'm familiar with that, and I know a lot of your book is made not for mental health professionals, you know, or for pastors, but it's created to equip ordinary people, normal people.
Yeah.
To be able to have these kinds of conversations and respond to people with compassion and in a genuinely helpful way. I think one of the temptations that I feel and that I hear from others that they feel when someone shares something really difficult like that, you know, one thing would be, like you're saying, to kind of back away. Mm-hmm. But when we engage, I think one of our fears is like, I don't know what to do if this becomes overwhelming. And so I wonder if you can share a little bit of like, what is it like to sit with someone who is in crisis without kind of rushing to fix their pain or explain it away or give them a Bible verse that says, oh, you shouldn't be so sad about that. Or, you know what I mean? Like that, I feel that that's an urge that most of us have because we care. It's like, oh, but also because we're anxious ourselves, you know, it's like, I want to do something about this, but how do we sit with someone without spiritualizing, in an unhelpful way, what they're going through?
Yeah, for sure. I think for sure people want to help. I don't think the issue for a lot of people is that they don't want to step in and help. I think way too often it is either this avoidance because I don't want to make it worse, or I feel unqualified for this, which is certainly why I wrote the book. Is like, if you could just have a couple of tools in your tool belt, all of a sudden it's like, oh, actually this is very doable. But then the other end of the spectrum is that, yeah, we can come on too strong sometimes and unintentionally do harm by kind of minimizing what they're going through. You know, we might be trying to offer perspective very quickly of like, well, hold on, it can't be that bad. I mean, look at what a great life you have. Look at all the great things that you have going on. And again, unintentionally, what that can communicate is, well, actually, if you were stronger, this wouldn't be that big of a deal, because you should be grateful for everything that you have. And it's like, well, it's not that I'm not grateful. I'm also just carrying this immense pain that I don't know what to do with. And so I think when I talk early on in the book of the need to lead gently in these situations. And I think Jesus, obviously, as the good shepherd, is who I point to throughout the entire book over and over again. Of just seeing the ways that he approaches people, or even in the Old Testament, when people are in these places of suicidal desperation, you never see God chastising them. You never see God saying like, no, don't do that. Don't think that way. Don't do something stupid. You know, Elijah gets to this place of suicidal desperation where he's like, God, just take my life. I'm no better than my ancestors. He's isolated himself. He's run to the end of himself. And God provides for him in that moment. He shows up and like meets his physical needs so that he can then bring him to this place on Horeb where he's like, I'm gonna show up in a pretty incredible way, but I need to meet your physical needs right now before we can move on to this next piece of it. And so I think for us, just being able and willing to gently step in, sit in, and do more listening than talking, really. most people want an opportunity to share how suicide became part of their journey. They want a place for the pain to be kind of released. It's like an overfilled balloon that just needs one little pinprick, and then all of a sudden all of this starts coming out. And that's not true for everyone. I have sat with students that just didn't know how to articulate or weren't ready to articulate what they were going through. But the vast majority of my experiences in this space, in asking this very difficult question of, are you thinking about suicide? Are you thinking about killing yourself? They want the opportunity to share. And I think in the narrative of Job, it's one of the most beautiful things that happens is that Job loses like every good thing in his life all within a very short time period. And then his wife's like, well, Job, clearly you pissed God off, so you might as well like curse God and die. Not a great spouse move. And, but in the midst of this, it says that his three friends, they hear of Job's suffering. They travel a long distance. Like they go out of their way. It costs them something to show up for him. And then it says that they sit with him in the dirt in silence for a week because they see that his suffering is too great for words. I think way more often than not, the most powerful thing we can do is just to sit and be present. And if they're not ready to talk yet, that's okay. And again, if suicide has become part of the conversation, it's like, well, we also want to make sure that you're safe here. And so, you know, there's some follow-up questions that we would want to ask of like, have you come up with a plan? Do you know when you're going to do it? Do you know how you're going to do it? The more of these questions they can answer, the further along in that journey they are. And yet I think for most people, it's even in that kind of a place, it's not that they really want to die. It's just that they're not sure how to keep living in their current pain. And so when they can start to feel like, oh, I'm not alone in this, and there's people that are willing to sit with me and walk with me through this, and ask the hard question. And again, just listen to my story. And then certainly, again, you're right. Reading the book is not going to make anyone a mental health expert by any stretch of the imagination, but hopefully at least gives you enough tools to know, okay, now what do I do? What are the next steps in this to help people get to safety? But it starts with just needing to be willing to step in, lean in, and listen to stories without trying to solve it. If someone's talking about suicide in that moment, you're not going to solve it. That's not the goal, is to solve it for them in that moment. The goal is to help them feel seen, help them feel safe, and make sure we keep them safe.
Yeah. Tommy, I appreciate like zeroing in on suicide to flesh out what things like safety and gentleness live like. But your book is actually about more than simply suicide. One of the things that I benefited from was your section on how to apologize. I mean, I was in a situation yesterday at lunch with Ben where somebody was like, hey, something you said several years ago really impacted me negatively. And I realized that like in my body lives how to be defensive, how to downplay or diminish what's happening, how to pivot to my good intentions or to try to justify myself. but it takes me a minute, even as someone committed to learning how to be wrong righteously, to remember like, what does it look like to be safe and gentle, a good shepherd, to somebody who says, you did something that bothered me or impacted me negatively? I know you can't go into all of it, but would you give us a few bits about what you talk about in your book about a righteous way to apologize?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the most healing things that someone can experience when they feel like someone in a place of spiritual leadership, especially, is just willing to own it and say, hey, I'm really sorry that it impacted you that way. Even if that wasn't the intention, even if it was like, that's not what I meant to do. And you know, we can get defensive and say, you should believe the best in me. And sure, there's elements of, I wish we could all do that. And yet I think because in places of spiritual leadership, our words carry so much weight that we should be quick to own and apologize what is ours to own and apologize for, because it can create such safety. That's one of the ways that you can create immense safety for people. My wife is so great at this, is that she will go to our kids constantly and be like, "Hey, I'm really sorry. Mommy shouldn't have talked to you that way. And I wish that I would have done it different than that. And next time I'll try to do it different than that." And it has literally changed the way that I lead my team at our church just by watching the way that she parents, because she's so quick to apologize like that. But I think when we recognize, oh, I have either someone else brings it up, or I'm an Enneagram 9, and so I don't need people to bring it up more often than not, I walk around with that guilt immediately. I'm like, I messed up on that one. I'm really sorry for that. But then being able to go in, we in our family used the 5-part apology. There's a few different versions of this floating around, but our version of this, step one would just literally be saying, "I'm sorry for," and being really specific of what do I need to apologize for? "I'm sorry for saying it that way," or "I'm sorry for the thing that I said that caused you pain," or whatever it is, just being really specific and owning what is ours to own within that. The second step of that would be labeling, "Hey, I know it made you feel," fill in the blank. "Like, I know when I spoke to you that way, it made you feel unsafe. It made you feel unseen in that moment. It made you feel whatever it might be." It's a recognition of how our actions impacted others. And again, just owning, like, I know that my actions did this to you. The third piece of it would be next time. It's this recognition of, I didn't do it great this time, but I'm going to work on this repentance aspect of, I'm going to turn around and try to do it different the next time. So next time I'm going to try to speak a little more calmly and kindly instead of the way that I got riled up there for a moment. And then step four would be just asking for forgiveness of, "Will you forgive me?" And I think that's honestly one of the things when people are saying, "Hey, I feel the need to apologize," we will say that, but then not ever get around to actually saying, "I'm sorry, will you forgive me?" And again, it also gives people agency to be able to own, like, "I don't know if I'm ready to do that yet. I can't demand your forgiveness, but I can ask for it genuinely." And then step five would be, "How can I make it better?" This is the offer of restitution within the relationship of, like, moving forward, how can I make this right with you? And in our own family with our kids, more often than not, it's just, "Hey, with a hug, like, I just need a hug. I need a repair of this relationship right now." Sometimes it's, "I need a little space right now." And it's being willing to say, "Okay, again, as an Enneagram 9, I really want our relationship to be okay, but I'm going to walk away and give you the space that you need right now because that's what you asked for." And again, I'm trying to give you agency within this. And yeah. I think when we can come back with this kind of ownership, when we get it wrong, because as shepherds of any kind, whether you're a parent or pastor or leader, we're not going to be perfect. The quicker we can own that and work to make the relationship right is one of the ways I think we can create the most psychological, emotional safety for people. Cause it's like, oh, no, actually they are a safe place. They're willing to own it when they get it wrong.
Yeah. As an Enneagram 9, I'm sure you can appreciate that some of us, and I've experienced this too, when we're in a conflict situation, our nervous systems may be on heightened alert. Yeah. And so I've had to say, "Hey, when you did this, it bothered me." And in the moment, I feel like, okay, I got what I needed. Things are resolved. But then I go away. My nervous system calms down. And my brain's like, I didn't ask about this. Or I really wanted to press in more here. Or there was this other thing that happened that I didn't bring up. And so I'm wondering, too, like, part of making it right could be like, "Hey, I appreciate this conversation. If you need to revisit this at any time, in any way you need to do that, I'm willing to do that with you. And if you want somebody else here for that, for your own care and safety, let's do it." And I feel like that's a commitment to repair and reconciliation, especially keeping in mind how our bodies work and how sometimes in conflict, we aren't dealing with a full deck, we're really tripped out, sometimes. So anyway, I just really appreciate, it feels like knowing how to apologize should have been something we learned before we started kindergarten. And most of us, have to learn that. We have to hack our ways into that as adults.
Yeah.
You know, just piggybacking on that, Matt, I think not only do we kind of can circle back around and be like, hey, like, how are you feeling? And, but like actually 2 or 3 days later, after a hard conversation, when you have apologized, going back to that person and saying, is there anything else? Was there anything else stuck on your heart that we need to keep talking about? I have found when people do that for me, it's super powerful, but I also think it's really powerful when I can have the maturity and the thought and the care to actually do that for somebody else too, in an apology setting. It doesn't always happen, but I do think it's really powerful. So, anyway.
Yeah. And just normalizing, I think Tommy, one of the important things about what you're saying is like, we can preach good sermons about becoming reconciled people. We can preach all kinds of sermons assuring people that we want to be a safe place. We can talk about good leadership, not Gentile leadership, but servant leadership. Maybe we use that phrase in our churches. But embodying it and demonstrating it over and over again is the only way to change the culture of a church. And those of us who stand closest to the thermostat have the most responsibility and power to do that.
Yeah. Absolutely. This is so good.
So I have like a personal question. I'm just going to go right into my own, like, I need your help because I think other people need your help too in this. I think a lot of times we need self-care and I'm not sure like how to help people like pastors, parents, ministry leaders, like understand the importance of self-care. But sometimes this just recently happened. I sat with somebody who their child died and they were just in the midst of grief and just loss, and they were devastated. It had only happened like a couple of months before, so they're still in the midst of the throes of it. And the dad asked me to read something that he wrote. And so I read it, and it was very raw and very real. And I read it silently, and then I handed it back to him. And I basically said, I'm so sorry. Ooh, it's going to make me cry now. I just was like, I don't have words for you, but can I just sit here with you? And then we cried together. Like, he just started crying and I started crying, and my heart was like, it's not my story, but this man was just so broken. And I left that time and I got in my car and I cried like the whole way home. And part of that was just the empathy that I felt for him, the sadness, the feeling like, I mean, I did eventually in our conversation ask him some questions of like, have you thought about counseling? I did ask him if he was thinking about killing himself. Like, I did do all the things, right? But my heart was still kind of bleeding afterwards. And I recognize, again, it's not my story, it's his. But as people who are trying to care for people, there is this self-care. Like, we hold stories like that often. And so I'm wondering if you can kind of share with us, what are some warning signs that shepherds are kind of running on empty? And then what does it look like to actually shepherd with like an open, gentle heart and really care for ourselves as well? Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Being open-hearted is a hazard. Is what you're saying,
kind of, it feels, yeah. I mean, like, and in fact, I've had people actually say that to me, like, oh, you need to care less. And I'm like, I don't think so. I think it's that I care, but I also take care of myself too. And so like part of those things, I'm like, I'm in counseling and I'm like, have a group of people that are my people. Like, but I want to hear from you, Tommy, like, what do you say to that?
I think that's a beautiful thing, honestly, that we should weep with those who weep. We should have this impact. If we get to the place where we're not being impacted by this pain, especially with people that we are deeply connected to, I think that is one of the warning signs of, if I'm compartmentalizing so much that I sit with someone who is in that kind of a place of deep pain, and then I'm immediately whistling on my way back to the car, like, there's something wrong with that, right? And in their book Boundaries, Cloud and Townsend, they talk about this difference between everyone has to kind of carry their own burden of daily toil. There are certain things that's like, I can't expect anyone else to carry that for me. Dealing with my own emotional outbursts, that's not anyone else's responsibility, but mine, to learn how to handle myself well in those moments. But then there's also, Paul says in Galatians 6, that we should also carry each other's burdens. And I think in these kinds of situations, when it's something that crushing, if we tried to carry it ourselves, when we're the ones going through it, we would be crushed by that. You can't carry a boulder by yourself. But collectively, with a lot of people around, an entire community helping to lift you up in the midst of that, it is manageable when there's lots of people helping out. But the same could be true for shepherds. If I try to carry that boulder for you, I too am going to be crushed by that. And so I think we need to pay attention to what are our own self-care routines. And I get it, for a lot of people in the wider culture, self-care can sometimes just equate to, you know, if you ever watched the show Parks and Rec, of like, treat yourself, of like just trying to have these moments of like, yeah, I'm just going to extravagantly blow money to make myself feel better. Well, that's maybe not what it looks like, but there is a version of self-care, especially as shepherds, to be able to say, I have to spend my own time at the feet of the Good Shepherd. I have to make sure that I'm allowing myself to be lifted up and shepherded by others as well. And there's a laundry list in the book of this kind of choose your own adventure of different ideas of what it could look like. Yeah. But I think to pay attention to the warning signs of, am I starting to become emotionally numb? Am I walking away from situations like that? And it's like, it's just too much. I can't let myself feel that right now. There's a healthy version of compartmentalization where it's like, okay, I need to kind of lock that one away because I'm about to go in and play with my kids. And like, I need to be able to show up well for them. But if I never go back and face it, if I never go back and unlock that chest and decide like, okay, now it's time to let it out and let myself feel this, then that's just going to keep getting stored up. And Sigmund Freud is credited with saying that unexpressed emotions never die. They're just buried, and then they come alive later in unhealthier ways. Yeah. And so I think what's really hard is we can try to numb ourselves from the pain, but you can't selectively numb. If you try to numb yourself from the pain, you're also going to numb yourself from the joy and from the good things that we want to experience as well. And so I think it's learning, what is my process to make sure, again, whether I'm seeing my own counselor, and shepherds need shepherding too, I have to have my own therapist that I'm walking with because this is heavy to carry, that I've got like my wife, there's times where it's like, hey, I need you to help carry this with me. And then there's other times where it's like, I don't want to dump everything on you that I've been carrying all day. And so there are times where it's like, yeah, she's not going to be the one that I'm going to dump that on and ask to carry that with me. But so who are those safe people? What are the routines for ourselves? Because if we get to this place where it's like, I'm on the verge of burnout, I just cannot keep doing this indefinitely, that's a pretty clear sign we need to address some things in ourselves. Like, we're maybe carrying too much of it for them rather than just with them. Yeah. And so figuring out with help, I think, what are the steps that I'm going to take to make sure that I still have more to pour out, that I'm not getting to a place where I'm just exhausted myself.
Listener, if you are looking for ways to get more deeply involved in what we do at Gravity and at the same time support the work that we're doing, I might invite you to think about spiritual direction.
Yeah, Thursdays are one of my favorite days because Thursday I meet with my friend Courtney for spiritual direction. And it's a conversation that we have, an hour long, and we talk about, where are you noticing God's activity in your life? And we do that together.
Well, that sounds great. Ben, could you give us a definition? What do you think spiritual direction is?
I'm actually finishing up school for spiritual direction. And that was one of the assignments, was to kind of write out your own version of it. Here's what mine is. Spiritual direction is a process of prayerful conversation that facilitates growing awareness of God's presence and involvement in your ordinary life. That invites you deeper into surrender to God's love and a fuller participation in the life that God shares with us. So yeah, if you're interested, go to gravitycommons.com/direction and obviously reach out. If you have any questions about that, you can email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com.
You have a chapter on this, right? It's chapter 9, where you talk about how to take care of yourself mentally, socially, emotionally, spiritually. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's some good suggestions in there, Tommy. Mm. I don't know if you've seen them, but they're really good.
I appreciate that. Honestly, most of that list, I think I even say this in the book, most of that list are things that I've done at different seasons to make sure that I'm, again, not getting to a place of burnout and compassion fatigue where it's like, I'm carrying too much weight for too many people. And so I can't show up well for you in the midst of that. Like if we start getting to that place as leaders, that's, it's not great for us certainly, but it's also not great for the people we lead either.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, one of the lessons I've had to learn is just, it's not enough to know that about that. You know, it's like, oh yeah, I know that about myself. You know, it's like, no, you actually have to do those things. Knowing about them doesn't actually help that much.
Yeah.
Blessed are you if you do them, Ben.
Right. Yeah. Blessed are you if you do them. I had to go back and listen to Jesus again. So anyway, Tommy, it's been great to chat with you. The book that we're talking about, again, is called Shepherds of the Mind. Looking for the subtitle here. There it is, Caring Like Christ in an Age of Silent Suffering. Tommy, if people want to, obviously they can pick up the book if they want to read more about this, learn more about this, but how can they interact with you and the rest of your work? Where can they find you online?
I think the best place would be shepherdsofthemind.com. Just going there, you can find links for the book. You can find some of my sermons and podcasts and stuff like that if they're interested, but then also links to my social media and things like that. And so shepherdsofthemind.com.
Can I just give a shout out real quick about that?
Yeah.
There's some resources, a discussion guide for groups on that site. There's also a... I've never seen this before, but there's an audiobook companion guide PDF that I think everyone who reads the book should grab. It's a great summary and compendium to what this book is about. And I think it would help readers have a digest summary. I don't know, it's like 10 pages or something. Plus, there's great resources at the end for people who need like glossaries, but also help. So anyway, just a shout out for that. It's not your average book site, is what I'm saying.
No.
You know,
appreciate
it's pretty good.
Gold star. Well, Tommy, thank you so much for being with us. I just want to say I'm thankful for your book and for your writing, but I'm thankful for who you are. And who you are is demonstrated in the way that you live. And so these words that you've written in this book are not just a great idea or a thought. It's lived out. So I appreciate that. Appreciate you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. Such a joy to be with you guys. Thanks for what you all do as well.
So y'all, I was thinking as we were listening, just Chrissy, as you were talking about like living open-hearted and caring and how to carry well and how... Like sometimes we vacillate between caring too much and then checking out, you know.
Yeah.
Ben and I have a friend, a ministry friend, who took a new job at a church, and he's in the middle of 6 funerals in 2 weeks.
Holy cow.
And an 8-year-old in his community died suddenly during a ballet class. And he was leading... Am I right, Ben? Is it 8?
Yeah, yeah.
And he had to lead a vigil at the school for families and other kids. And, you know, he just messaged us. We messaged back and forth. He's like, can you guys just pray for me as I lead this? And then, you know, we have a couple in our church. A woman was in a tragic car accident and she survived, but she spent 2 weeks in the hospital. She's going to be 12 weeks in her home. I visited with them on Sunday. I mentioned it's a hazard. Some experts call it moral injury, or compassion fatigue.
Yeah.
But I experience it as it's too much.
Yeah.
It feels too heavy.
Yeah.
You know?
you know, Ben and I were sharing about a situation in our church that we don't really have any control over, but we're both hurting because of it yesterday. It's like you just keep adding suffering and pain. Mm-hmm. Most of the people who deconverted that I know in my life did so, not because they wanted to gamble yep. or play poker,
yep.
but it was because they were hurt
yeah,
or are hurting. And pain, the problem of pain didn't become some fun theology pub night conversation topic. It became an existential question of who am I and how, what kind of universe do I live in fundamentally?
Yeah.
And so I just want to just name that being human and alive is a lot. 8-year-olds have always died suddenly. This isn't the first 6-funeral 2-week span for a pastor. This isn't the first car accident where somebody, whatever. All of that continues to happen, and we've got craziness happening around the world.
Yeah.
You know, I'm planning my errands for the next week to minimize my gas usage because I'm going to pay double what I paid 2 weeks ago.
Right.
And that's one of 10,000 things where stuff is bonkers, you know?
Yeah.
And so I guess I just want to hear from both of you, like, how do you, what metaphors or pictures come to mind as you think about bearing pain and suffering others and your own, bearing it faithfully? Hmm. How to stay open-hearted in a world that is hazardous to the human heart?
That's a good question. And I'm generally like a picture person. Like I like to think of things in pictures. I don't know if I have a picture for this. I mean, actually Tommy has like a lot of analogies in his book that I think are really helpful. Mm-hmm. But maybe instead of a picture, I'll just share some practices that are a little bit religious for me in yeah. the midst of the pain.
This is a and religious are, friendly space.
That's okay, Christy.
You know, I change the amount of counseling that I do based on the season that I'm in. And so right now, like my boss is on sabbatical and so I have more responsibility for the next 4 months. And so I just upped my counseling to like every week. Every week I meet with my therapist because I was finding that since my boss is gone, I'm holding more stories of people in our sphere, in our congregation. And it's hard. It like, I care about these people and I want to hear and I want to be present to them. But if I don't share, I don't want Paul to be the one to always have to hold all of that. And yeah. so I literally pay somebody, you know, like, and she helps me process that. So that's one thing. And then I've mentioned it before, but I have grief sessions that I put in my calendar. It's basically every 10 days that I put like 45 minutes in my calendar and I cry. And I know that sounds kind of wild because you're like, how do you force yourself to cry? I don't have to force myself to cry. It's like, it's like in my throat by the time, you know, 9 or 10 days gets, it's like, I just write out on a piece of paper all the things that my heart is feeling and often comes with an expression of tears. And if I don't do that, it comes out sideways. And yeah. so it is one of those ways, like I think self-care ways of taking care of myself and being able to express in healthy ways the grief that I hold on behalf of other people.
Yeah.
Yeah. The phrase, really wise,
Christy, I think.
The phrase like spiritual hygiene came to mind, Christy, when you said that. Like crying is hygiene. It's cleansing.
I was just going to say, Christy, I think your suggestions are really wise. Especially like I find for me, it feels counterintuitive for me that when I'm busy, I need more time like in therapy or in prayer or in, you know, like I need more time when I'm busy because it feels counterintuitive because I'm like, usually for me, the first excuse for not praying
right.
or, you know, it's like, well, I don't have time right now. It's right. a busy season, you know? And so I think it's really key to just embrace the limitations of being human and say, oh, if I am busy, and this, you know, and there's no way to minimize the busyness if it's a genuinely important time for mm-hmm. me to be engaged. You know, I think we see this in Jesus' ministry a lot, where, you know, the crowds are just clamoring and he has compassion on the crowds, right? Because they're like sheep without a shepherd. But he is always also trying to get his disciples away. We need to mm-hmm. go away, you know, and he's always waking early to go and pray. And so there was a sense in which he understood as a human what his natural limitations were and what he needed to do to be able to sustain the ministry that he was called into. And so I think a lot of your suggestions are really wise. And I think they comport with how I'm learning to think about my own life. I think there's a sense in which for me, like just regular times, not just in like regular times for me in like centering prayer, contemplative prayer, are really important, where I am sort of just placing myself in as open a posture as I can before God and allowing God to, like, I don't actually know what's happening in me most of the time. But I do know that tears come most of the time.
Yeah.
And I think that part of what God is doing in those moments is, you know, allowing grief to move through me, and allowing my soul to kind of be replenished and restored and all of that. And so I think there's like daily things. I love your every 10 days, you know, grief work kind of thing. I think that's intentional and important. Another thing that I remembered to do, I mean, Matt, you've been on, listener, Matt's back, by the way.
He's back.
We just told our listeners that you had disappeared and we're not sure how much.
But you had great things to say. We just,
I'm sure it was great.
Can I give a report?
We were sure it was great.
Yeah, please
do. Yeah, what happened, Matt?
I was caught up in the third heaven. Whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows, though.
God knows. And now you can't share anything about it, though, right?
That's the deal.
That was part of Paul's
deal.
Yeah. You just, all you can share is that it happened.
All I get to do
really say anything about it.
Is humble brag.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like the Apostle Paul.
Just like the Apostle Paul.
Yeah.
No, what
anyway,
I
was just going to say the other thing. Like for me, seasonal, like vacation, taking all of my vacation time. Like we're allowed 4 weeks of vacation and 1 week of retreat and a week of continuing ed. And I just recently realized that I had not intentionally scheduled all that out. And so I just, I did. Taking a week off in June and September and October. Anyway,
it's good.
Figure that all out. That's important for me as well. Just taking regular time to be away for more than just a few hours, you know?
Yeah.
A few days. Yeah.
Well, what I was saying before I realized you guys couldn't hear me was that, Christy, your scheduled regular, I'll call it like regimen of crying, is spiritual hygiene.
Oh, yeah.
It is hygiene. It's as important as brushing our teeth or showering or doing laundry.
Yep.
And I think that we have a culture that pathologizes sadness and crying.
Yeah.
Boys are told to stop crying, and women, if they cry, are taught to apologize for it. Mm-hmm. That's very generalized gendered scripts, but like I'm just using that as an example. Like crying is not honored,
right.
It's not valued.
Yep.
Anyway, I appreciated you saying that.
Yeah. Well, I hope people get the book. I think it's worth the read and
needed.
And really needed, yeah. Mm-hmm. So
yeah. You guys know how.
All right, well,
you guys know how before I went on sabbatical, I would always drop in a joke here.
I remember that. I do, and I actually noticed last time you didn't, and I didn't know what to do with myself.
That was, I mean, everyone laughed when I said I wanted to become a comedian. But now the joke's on you. And nobody's laughing now.
Matt, we love you.
Nobody's laughing now.
Yeah. True enough.
Awkward silence.
Mm-hmm. All right, Chrissy. Okay, just for
maybe
you.
Maybe that was one of the things that happened in the third heaven for Matt.
Just for you.
He was told to stop it.
You want to hear the joke that I heard in the third heaven?
Please tell us. What do you call it?
Oh, man. What do you call it when? What's your sexual orientation if you're attracted to both men and women, but they aren't attracted to you? I have
no idea. What do you call it?
It's called by yourself.
That's a good one. That's a good one. Made me belly laugh.
By yourself. I was going to guess. Bye.
Bye. Yeah.
Bye. Bye.
Anyway, all right, everybody.
Oh, friends. Good to be with you.
Bye.
See y'all.
Peace.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast, and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect there with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith and spirituality and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. Finally, we would love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, you can go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.